Welcome to BBA Audits, What Tax Attorneys Need to Know. I'm Philip Behrendt, Chair of the Beverly Hills Bar Association's Tax Law Section. The tax section is sponsored by Hochman Salk and Tosha Perez. Hochman Salk and Tosha Perez law firm advantage is experience, an eye for innovation, and a genuine dedication to clients, their families, and their business. In addition to their national practice in civil tax and criminal tax controversies and related litigation in federal and state courts, we also advise doing audits. And I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Jennifer Black and Robert Horwitz. Jennifer Black is managing director in Sidwell & Cooperman's National Tax Office and has over two decades of combined legal and accounting experience. She has extensive experience dealing with complex tax issues, including partnerships, audit procedures under the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982, better known as TEFRA, and the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, known as BBA. The interaction between TEFRA and collection due process procedures and disclosure issues involving Section 6103, the Privacy Act and the Freedom of Information Act. Prior to Sidwell & Cooperman, Jenny was senior counsel for the IRS Office of Chief Counsel in the Procedure and Administration Division. She served as a primary resource for both BBA and TEFRA matters and was essential in implementing the BBA regime, including developing policies, interpreting statutes, authoring regulations, reviewing and creating new forms, and assisting in developing internal procedures to perform examination under the BBA. Robert Horwitz is attorney principal at Hochman Salk and Tosha Perez, has over 35 years of experience as a tax attorney, specializing in the representation of clients in civil and criminal tax matters, including civil audits and appeals, tax collection matters, criminal investigation, administrative hearings, and in civil and criminal trials and appeals in federal and state courts. He has served as a member of the executive committee of the tax section of the State Bar of California and was chair of the tax section for 2015 to 2016. He was previously chair of the tax procedure and litigation committee of the State Bar Taxation section. And now let's get started. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Philip. Next slide.
Yeah, if you could advance to slide five, that's slide. Where the actual presentation starts. There we go. That's just all us. There you go.
Okay. Well, first we're going to deal with what the BBA, which is the Balanced Budget Act of 2015 applies to. And basically, it's called the Centralized Partnership Audit Regime, is the formal name, and it applies to all partnerships for tax years that begin on or after January 1, 2018. For tax years ending after the BBA was enacted and prior to January 1, 2018, a partnership could elect to be audited under the BBA rules, and BBA applies unless a partnership elects out of the BBA. You can elect out of the BBA only if there are no more than 100 partners for the taxable year, and all the partners have to be either individuals, C corporations, S corporations, foreign entities that would be C corporations if they were domestic, and estates of deceased partners. So you can't have a partnership, a disregarded entity like a single member LLC, a trust, or an estate that is a partner. Now then, the number of partners are based on the number of K-1s issued by the partnership. And if one of the members is a S corporation, then you include the number of K-1s issued by the S corporation to its partners. So if there's 91 partners and an S corporation has 10 shareholders to whom it issues K-1s, then it's going to be 101 partners, So you have to take that in consideration. Under the regulations, if an estate of a deceased partner issues K-1s to benefit several beneficiaries, it's not going to be treated as increasing the number of K-1s. So an estate that has five beneficiaries who get K-1s, if the estate is a partner, it's only going to be treated as one partner. Now, the election out has to be made on a timely filed tax return. And the election is made, there's a Q&A questions on the return, question 33 on the current 1065 asks if the partnership is electing out of BBA, and if there is an election out, the partnership would check the box yes and would complete a Schedule B2 election out, which would require it to include the names and TINs of all the partners, including the indirect partners through who hold an interest through a S corporation. Next slide, please. Now then, the audit of the BBA occurs at the partnership level, and all of the adjustments are required to be determined at the partnership level. The adjustments are to what are called partnership-related items, and we'll be dealing with that on the next slide. And they also apply to any penalty, addition to tax, or additional amount, which are basically the section, the Chapter 63 A and B penalties, which would relate to any adjustment. And they also apply to any legal or factual determination underlying an adjustment. An example would be whether what period of limitations applies to making the adjustment. If there's a determination there was a 25% understatement of tax or there was fraud, that would be a legal or factual determination that would be determined at the partnership level. Okay, now then, it only applies to income taxes. It doesn't apply to self-employment taxes. It doesn't apply to state and gift taxes. It doesn't apply to net investment income taxes, foreign withholding taxes, employment taxes, or excise taxes. And the IRS can make adjustments to partnership-related items outside of BBA solely for purposes of these taxes. Next slide.
Just want to note something real quick as we're going on to the next slide. The penalties that can be determined under BBA are only those penalties that are on an adjustment to a partnership-related item. That means that any of your filing penalties, like if you fail to file the partnership return timely and any kind of filing penalty like that is not going to be subject to BBA.
Now we're going to get into partnership-related items, and partnership-related items are defined in Section 6241-2B, and which is part of the definition of adjustments, and it's detailed in Reg 301.6241-6. And a partnership adjustment is
Dash
any
one,
item.
6241-1, A6.
Oh, okay,
Do a little
dash
I.
one, A6.
Yeah, 6241-1 is all the definitions in the regs. Dash six is the coordination procedures.
Okay, so it's basically, it's any item with or amount with respect to the partnership that is relevant to determining the tax liability of any person under Chapter 1 and any partner's distributive share. And even though any person could mean anyone, whether a partner or not, the examples in the regulations show that basically it has to be a direct or indirect partner whose tax liability is affected. If it's someone who is not a partner or indirect partner, such as a vendor or a employee or a party that purchased an asset from the partnership who is not related to the partnership, then that person's liability would not be affected by the BBA procedures. Now then, how do you go about determining if something is a partnership-related item? It has to be an item or amount with respect to the partnership, and that means that it's got to be shown or required to be shown or reported on the partnership's Form 1065, or it's required to be maintained in the partnership's books or records. And
just want to clarify one thing that you said. When you're determining whether or not something has a has an impact on Chapter 1 liability, you don't look at anybody specifically. So it's not a matter of whose liability is impacted. The statute and the regulations provide that it, as long as it affects, it can affect Chapter 1 liability under the code, then that's what meets that requirement. So it's not a matter of, like, for Partnership 1, if the adjustment to liabilities would impact the liability of one of its partners, that it's a PRI, and a Partnership 2, that same adjustment wouldn't impact the adjustment, the tax liability of a particular partner, it's still a PRI. It's not dependent, because otherwise that would be completely unmanageable. So it's just whether or not that item can theoretically impact Chapter 1 liability under the code.
Okay. And basically, an item is or amount required to be shown on a return of a person other than the partnership that results after application of the code to a PRI based on the facts or circumstances of that person is not going to be a partnership item. And again, the regulations give an example of a partnership adjustment where the partnership has purchased $100 of widgets from individual A, and the IRS does a BBA audit, makes an adjustment to the widget amounts and the how the widgets are treated. That will affect the partnership, and it will be an adjustment of a partnership related item, but it will not affect the tax liability of the vendor who sold the widget to the IRS, assuming he is not a direct or indirect partner. And then Jenny has already gone over that it's basically theoretical. If it can have an effect on Chapter 1 tax, then it's relevant. Next slide, please. And these are examples of what are partnership-related items: character, timing, and source of the partnership's income, gain, loss, deductions, and credits. Character would be something as to whether something is ordinary income or capital gain, or whether it is an asset that can be depreciated or can be expensed. Timing would be the taxable year in which something should be included as income or deducted or claimed as a loss. Source would be, is the item of income such a thing as, is it business income of the partnership? Is it interest income? Is it gain from the sale of an asset? Then there are other examples of PRIs or contributions to and distributions from the partnership, including the value, amount, and character of the item contributed to or distributed by the partnership, the amount and character of liabilities. This would be whether or not not only the amount of the liability, but whether it's recourse, non-recourse, qualified non-recourse liability, the partnership's basis in its assets, capital accounts of the partners, elections made by the partnership, and whether or not a person is a partner in the partnership. And one of the main elections that often comes up in partnership audits is the 754 election, which would allow a partnership to adjust the basis in its assets if there is a transfer by sale, exchange, or a death of a partner of a partnership interest, or if there is a distribution of an asset to a partner. Next slide.
So now I'm going to talk a little bit about inconsistent treatment. For those of you familiar with TEFRA, you know that the partner has to file consistently with the partnership. I gave this talk one time and somebody raised their hand and they go, "Do you mean I've been not required to report consistently with my non-TEFRA partnership for these, the last 10 years?" I'm like, yes, technically. So what it means to report consistently with the partnership is that you have to treat the partnership-related items in the same way that the partnership did. So generally, those items on your K-1, so if they report to you that there's $100 of ordinary income, you have to report $100 of ordinary income. If you disagree with the treatment of the partnership, you can file inconsistently with the partnership, but you have to file it on those inconsistent treatment. Otherwise, the IRS can just turn around and math error assess you. So say, for example, my $100 example, you say, "Oh, no. I really was only allocated $80. I should not be allocated $100." You report $80 on your return instead of the 100. Now, if you don't file a notice of inconsistent treatment, the IRS can automatically adjust your return from 80 to 100 and just assess you the tax on that $20 without issuing a stat notice. If you file a notice of inconsistent treatment saying, "Hey, they reported me 100, I think it should only be 80," at that point, the IRS, if they disagree with you, would have to open a partner level audit. Now, there are also all p penalties for failing to file consistently with the partnership. If the partnership is a non-filer, like they hasn't filed a return yet, anything that you report with respect to that partnership is per se inconsistent. So that means if you are, waiting your K-1 from the partnership and you need to go ahead and file with an estimate, you should file a notice of inconsistent treatment if that K-1 would be coming from a BBA partnership, because otherwise it's per se inconsistent. If the partnership goes through an audit and there are adjustments, you can't file inconsistently from those audit adjustments because the partner is bound to those adjustments. Now, I do know there's a lot of misconceptions about inconsistent treatment. So outside of BBA and previously TEFRA, there is no requirement for a partner to file consistently with a partnership. Now, there is a requirement for S Corp shareholders to file consistently. That's Section 6037. So when you file inconsistently from a BBA partnership and you file your notice of inconsistent treatment, all it does is basically puts you in the same rules that would exist if BBA didn't exist. So, but that it doesn't mean that it allows the partner to take actions that it could not normally do. So for example, if you had a non-BBA partnership and it did not make a 754 election, the partner can't turn around and make that 754 election on their return and be like, "Oh, the partnership should have made that. I'm going to make it for them." Similarly, for BBA, if you file inconsistently from the partnership, it doesn't give you the ability to make to do things that the partner would not normally be able to do. So more or less, if the partner could do it outside of BBA, then they can generally do it in this situation as well. But inconsistent treatment is basically the character, the timing, and the amount of the item. But again, if you file inconsistently, please file a notice of inconsistent treatment. That is Form 8082. Next slide,
Jennifer,
please.
Jenny, if a partnership has elected out of BBA, do the rules of consistent treatment apply?
No, only to BBA and TEFRA partnerships. So outside of BBA, those rules don't apply. Next slide, please. Partnership representative or PR. So the PR is the, I like to describe the PR as the all-powerful Oz. The partnership selects this person, and this person has the sole authority to act on behalf of the partnership under BBA. The person has no power outside of BBA, but they have absolute authority inside of BBA. There's no requirement that it be a partner like it was for TMP under TEFRA. It can be any person, some random person off the street, your choice, so long as that person has a substantial presence in the United States. Now, if you don't choose one and you refuse to choose one, the IRS can select a PR for you. If the IRS determines you don't have a PR in effect, they give you 30 days to pick your person. But if you think you're going to be cute and just not name somebody and think it's going to stymie the IRS, no, they'll just pick somebody. So the partners in the partnership are bound by the actions taken by the PR, which is why I say he is the all-powerful Oz. They designate the partnership, the PR on the partnership return. It's a year-by-year designation. So just because you named me on your 2018 return doesn't make me the PR for 2019. You have to actually put me on the 2019 return as well. Similarly, if your partnership agreement says that John Doe is supposed to be the PR, but you put Jane Smith on that 1065, Jane Smith is your PR. You can change the PR, and then you do that using the form 8979. Now you just can't change the PR whenever you want. Pretty much it has to be in a circumstance where the PR will be taking a certain action, like filing an AAR, filing a Form 8985, if there's an if you're under audit. But basically, if the PR is not doing anything, then there's no ability to just change the PR, because otherwise you'd be sending in all these forms repeatedly and the IRS would be processing them in situations where it doesn't have any impact, which and obviously, especially with the resource issues at the IRS right now, they don't have, not going to be processing any forms. But if the PR needs to do something, at that point, you can always change the PR. Next slide, please. So who can be PR? As I kind of said, it can be anybody off the street so long as they have substantial presence in the United States. That is really a kind of a low bar. They have to make themselves available to meet in person with the IRS in the US at a reasonable time and place. They have to have a street address in the US, a US telephone number, and a US 10. I'll be honest, as long as the person is working with the IRS and not having any problems, it probably doesn't necessarily matter if they're in Hong Kong. If they're willing to meet with the IRS in the US, and has a US 10 and a US phone number, if it's not broke, don't fix it, basically. So the PR is that you've selected is good, unless and until the IRS says otherwise. The PR can be an entity. If you designate an entity as your PR, you must also appoint a designated individual or DI who will have sole authority to act on behalf of the entity PR. The designated individual must also have substantial presence in the United States. Now, I just want to make something clear that when I said you can pick anybody off the street, I do mean that. They don't, the PR, the DI doesn't have to have any relationship at all to the partnership. They don't have to have state law authority to bind the partnership. The DI doesn't have to have any relationship with the partnership. Only requirement to be the PR is substantial presence in the United States. Now, personally, I don't see, and a lot of people like to name entity PRs and name that DI. I'm personally on team individual PR. I don't see a real benefit to get to naming a entity PR because you're going to have to name a DI anyways, and that DI is going to be the one taking all the actions. So why not just pick the DI, the person you were going to pick as DI as the PR? But there are a lot of people that feel very strongly that they should have entity PR. I just think it adds a layer of complication that is unneeded because if you name an entity PR and you name John Doe is your DI, but Jane Smith is the managing member of the entity PR, and Jane Smith signs on behalf of that entity PR, it's not good. So if your push-out election is signed by the wrong person, it's not good. So that's why I like entity PRs. I mean, individual PRs over entity PRs, is because it's like you got the person's name and that's the person signing. You don't have to deal with anything else. But you are free to choose an entity if you want, so long as you name a DI. Next slide, please. This is a overall timeline of a BBA audit. It's just over sim it is just like simplified, as easy as I could make it. It starts with the NAP, then there's audit, and you can go to appeals on the merits of the adjustments. After that, if you do or do not go, a NOPA with two P's is issued, which gives you the right to request modification of the imputed underpayment. If any modifications are denied, then you can go to appeals solely on the denied modifications. You can't revisit the adjustments. If everything is not all agreed, the IRS issues an FPAW with 1A. You can make a push-out election. You can kind of see, you can either petition or not, and then it goes on to assessment and collection. There's a more complex version of this called the IRS Roadmap that LB&I put out a couple of years ago. You can probably Google it or find it on the IRS website. It's more detailed than this, and it has all the form numbers and letter numbers on it. So if you want to see all that together, I recommend going to that. I'm also going to do a general plug for the IRS's BBA website. It is very well done. It has a lot of information. It's updated routinely. There's actually a newsletter you can sign up for that will email you when a change is made to the website and like what the change was. So I highly recommend. It's a very well done website, and I'm signed up for the newsletter, so I recommend it. So Robert, what kind of notices do people get under BBA?
Okay, next slide. Well, there are three statutory notices, but prior to the statutory notices, when the IRS first selects a partnership for audit under the BBA regime, it will send a letter 2205D, which is a notice of selection for audit. And if it's going to audit several years, it will send one letter for each year that is going to be audited. And the letter is normally sent to the partnership. Then there are three statutorily required notices: the notice of administrative proceeding, which starts the audit process. Then, after the audit process is generally completed and the IRS has computed a proposed imputed underpayment, it will issue a notice of proposed partnership adjustment, the NOPA, which then triggers a right for the taxpayer to seek for the partnership to invoke the modification procedures and seek to have the imputed underpayment modified. And then notice of final partnership adjustment, the FPA, which basically is the ticket for the partnership to either do a push-out election, and also if it wants to dispute the proposed adjustments in either tax court, district court, or the Federal Court of Claims. All of the three statutory notices have to be mailed to both the partnership and the partnership representative at their last known addresses. And the partners are not entitled to notice from the IRS, unlike TEFRA, where partners were entitled to notice. And partners could participate in the audit process. So basically, as Jenny noted, the PR is the all-powerful Oz. The partners have no say in what goes on in the proceedings. If partner, the IRS does not have to consider anything the partners say or do during the proceedings. A partners cannot initiate a judicial proceeding. Remember, in TEFRA, if the partnership did not file a timely petition in tax court, a partner could institute a judicial proceeding to challenge the adjustments in the notice of partnership administrative adjustment. Now, then, there's a question about whether a partner can intervene in a partnership proceeding under BBA. If you look at Tax Court Rule 64B, there is permissive intervention, which is basically if an individual has a stake in the outcome of the proceedings and that no party adequately protects, tax court can allow that person to intervene in the proceedings. So, that would basically be a fact and circumstance test. This is somewhat different than the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 24, which basically allows permissive intervention only if there is a statutory right to conditionally intervene or if there's a claim or defense that shares issues of fact or law with the issues raised in the main action. So, someone may not, an individual partner may not be able to intervene in a partnership proceeding if it was instituted in district court or federal court of claims, and potentially could intervene if it was instituted in the tax court. Next slide.
I just want to note that under TEFRA, because all the partners were parties to the proceeding and the partnership is not a partner to the proceeding, all partners had the right to participate in the proceeding. And I can tell you, in the 12 years I did TEFRA, I think I saw somebody participate one time. So they never did it under TEFRA. I'll be curious to see if people try to do it under want to intervene under TEFRA, I mean a BBA, but I guess nobody ever did it under TEFRA and they had an absolute right to do so. So it'll be curious. I don't think there's any problem with people intervening so long as they meet the test, but it's also going to be hard to figure out who has an interest. You know, if it's that they didn't elect push out, you don't know who the partner's going to be.
Okay, now this basically details the various notices. The first is the notice of selection for exam, and this is basically the extreme right-hand column discusses some of the things to be done if a partnership gets a letter 2205D. It should engage counsel or someone to represent it. It could be an accountant, it could be an attorney, someone who has expertise in dealing with the IRS and dealing with BBA audits. The partnership could con should consider whether it wants to change the partnership representative or the designated individual of the partnership representative, because there's only a very limited window of opportunity to make that adjustment. And then this also kicks off the time to file an administrative adjustment request, because once the notice of administrative proceeding is issued, you cannot make an administrative adjustment request. And there's usually 30 days lapse between the issuance of the letter 2205D and the issuance of the notice of administrative proceedings. Once the notice of administrative proceeding is issued, the partnership can no longer file an administrative adjustment request. And there's going to be an opening conference, like in any audit, an opening conference with the examining agent, and IDRs are going to be issued. And if the additional time is needed, the IRS will request the partnership representative to execute a statute extension to extend the statute of limitations. Then, after the IRS examining agent has completed the audit, a summary report will be issued. And this includes the preliminary audit results and the proposed imputed underpayment. It includes a letter which has instructions for requesting a conference with the examining agent, and the Form 886A, the explanation of items, which will have a explanation of the rash reasons for any adjustments being proposed in the summary report. Next slide. Then, shortly after the summary report is issued, the IRS is going to issue a 30-day letter to the partnership representatives, which includes instructions on how to file a protest with IRS appeals if the partnership disagrees with the proposed adjustments. And they also will include the same form that was with the summary report for preliminary IU calculation, and another form 886A. And then, if you're going to file a notice on a protest, this is the time to do so. You have 30 days to do it. If you fail to file a protest within the 30-day period, the IRS can basically send the case to the technical services unit to issue the NOPA. If you do file a protest, first the IRS is going to require you to grant an extension of time if there are not at least 18 months remaining on the statute of limitations for assessment. And then once the protest is filed, the examining agent can prepare and submit to appeals a rebuttal to the protest, explaining why the agent thinks that the protest is incorrect. And then it appeals, you will, if there is appeals, and the parties can reach an agreement as to when what the adjustments are, then they could sign an agreement as to the adjustments. Now then, once appeals is done, the NOPA will be issued by appeals, and it's issued to both the partnership and the partnership representative. And it will include instructions for the modification requests, the final imputed underpayment amount, and any revisions to the Form 886A. And what you have to do then is, if there is going to be a modification request, it has to be submitted within 270 days of the NOPA being issued. And you can request an extension. It's unlike the extensions for the statute of limitations on assessment, which the IRS usually initiates. The partnership has to be the party requesting the extension, and the extension has to be requested in sufficient time so that the IRS can sign the extension, approve the extension before the 270-day period expires. Because if the IRS doesn't sign the extension before the expiration, then it can't be extended. A partnership can consider waiving the modification period, in which case the FPOW would be issued.
All right, we have a question in
Yes.
the chat asking, waiving the 270-day period is extremely difficult. Can you comment on how to make that waiver? There's a specific form for it. I don't know why it would be difficult. The IRS usually will give you the form, I believe, with the NOPA often, or at least mention it in the NOPA. I haven't pulled up the letter for the NOPA in a while, but I just want to tell your question. I'm trying to, I think it's Form 8981. So you could fill out the Form 8981 and have your PR sign it, and that's how you would do the waiver of the modification, remainder of the modification period. And you can also do that after you submit your modification request. So if you submit your modification request on day 100 and you're like, I'm done, I don't want to sit around and wait anymore, you can wait the remainder of it.
Well, it's similar though to a regular IRS audit. When the IRS issues the notice of deficiency, the taxpayer can waive his right to go to tax court and the deficiency can be assessed. So similarly, you can waive the modification period. And then after, if modification is requested, the IRS will determine whether or not to allow the modifications. And they'll issue a modification determination package. And if the taxpayer disagrees with the modification determination, if the IRS does not allow the modifications or only allows them in part, the PR can file a protest and go to appeals, challenging the IRS's modification determination. And then once, and at the end of that, the partnership representative can agree to modifications, can waive the notice, the right to receive a FPAW notice, in which case that would end the case, and then the IRS would basically either assess the partnership, or if the partnership has elected a push-out election, do the push-out election.
No,
Or no.
you have to have an FPAW to make a push-out election.
Okay.
So if you sign the NOPA agreeing to the adjustments, if you read what you actually sign, it'll say, I'm consenting to the assessment and collection of the imputed underpayment determined in the NOPA. You have to have an FPAW to push out. So if you want to push out, don't sign that. So you can get an FPAW so that you can make a push-out election. But if you just Just go ahead, read it before you sign it, but you have to have an FPAW in order to make the pushout election.
I thought in the IRM there was provision that you can sign the the 15027, the modification document,
With
and
the
the
FPAW, that
FPAW.
comes with the FPAW.
Okay.
So the FPAW is letter think 5933. It's form 15027 and the 886A. So if you receive the FPAW, you can make the election within the 45 days, and you can sign the 15027. But you have to make that, or you could just default. I think the Let me look at the back end of the 15027, but you have to you could you get the 15027 at two different points in the audit. You get it if you've requested modification of the imputed underpayment. You'll get it when the IRS makes the determination as to the modifications that you requested, and it's part of the FPAW. So it's going to show you the adjustments that are being made, as well as the I have the 15027 here, as well as the modifications that have been approved. And so the last page. Okay, yeah, it doesn't say
Okay.
anything. Yeah, so if you sign the 15027, you're not waiving your right to request make a pushout election, but you have to have an FPAW to make a pushout election. So if you don't get an FPAW,
No pushout
no
election.
pushout election.
And you get 45 days after the FPAW is issued to make the pushout election, and then you have 90 days after the FPAW is issued to file a petition with either the tax court, the district court, or the federal court, Court of Federal Claims. And if you go to the district court or the Court of Federal Claims, you're required to make a deposit. Next slide. Okay, a partnership is any adjustment to a partnership-related item, and basically it's a adjustment that is to a monetary money number, which can be
That's my
baked.
term.
Yeah, I know.
It's
But
official.
it's basically any if it's
It's got a
the
dollar sign in
modify.
front of it.
Yeah, if it's got a dollar sign, it's a money adjustment. So if you go to the K Schedule K or K-1, and there is an adjustment to a liability, even though that is not something normally considered in determining the income deductions credits on the partnership, it will be an adjustment that can go into computation of the IU. A change to an asset can go into the computation of an IU, such as recharacterizing a changing what determining whether or not an asset is depreciable. If the partnership has purchased a piece of property with a building on it and allocated 90% of the purchase price to the building, the IRS goes in and says only 50% of the purchase price is to the building, that's going to be a change that is going to be computed as part of the IU. So basically, money numbers. Things such as an adjustment as to the number of hours for the energy credit, that's not a money number. Whether an election was proper isn't a money number, but there are adjustments. However, the determination that an election was not valid can affect the money numbers on the returns. And similarly, a change as to the number of kilowatt hours for the energy credit could affect money numbers. Next slide. Oh, and back, can we go back to the bottom of the prior slide? It doesn't matter whether or not a partner would have paid tax on the adjustment if had it appeared on the return. If it's an adjustment to a money number, it is going to be taken into account in computing the IU. And so if you have normally, you wouldn't consider the how liabilities are characterized on the Schedule K-1 as being a number, money number, but if there is a reallocation of a liability from recourse to non-recourse, that is going could change the tax liability of one or more of the partners because the partners may no longer may have not be at risk. So then there are positive and negative adjustments which go into the imputed underpayments. And under the regulations, under the BBA, the negative adjustments are any item that will increase decrease an item of income or increase a credit. And so an increase in an expense is a negative adjustment. A decrease in capital gains is a negative adjustment. A decrease in ordinary income is a negative adjustment. An increase in a capital loss is a negative adjustment. An increase in a credit is a negative adjustment. And you could have a offsetting negative adjustment. Any other adjustment is going to be a positive adjustment. So if you increase a capital gain and reduce ordinary income, you're going to have a negative adjustment to ordinary income, but a positive adjustment to an increase in capital gains. And adjust now then below are the examples of some of the positive adjustments. As we mentioned, an increase in ordinary income, decreasing expenses, decreasing capital losses, increasing capital gains, decreasing credits, adjustments to non-income items. Those are not negative adjustments. Next slide, please. And I'm going to hand it off to Jenny now.
I just want to make, I know a lot of people like to think of the adjustments as taxpayer favorable and taxpayer unfavorable. I would highly recommend you don't do that. Use the definitions of positive and negative adjustments because not thinking of things as taxpayer favorable, taxpayer unfavorable will not get you to the right answer in all cases. In addition, some adjustments can be favorable for one partner but unfavorable for another. So I know people do it. I hear it a lot. I always say think of them, use the definitions of positive and negative adjustments because otherwise you may end up in a situation where you've gotten it wrong because of using the term taxpayer favorable and unfavorable. Now moving on to choices. So BBA is really a regime of partnership choices. There are three major choices that the partnership can make in BBA audits. They can be, for the most part, mix and matched up. If so, if you, for example, you can pay an imputed underpayment with respect to some adjustments and push out with respect to others if you do multiple imputed underpayments, which you can do. So, I always, this is a thing I've been talking about a lot lately because I don't think that people really go through the analysis of what these particular options are for their clients. And they all, I'm always going to push out. And I go, well, what do you mean you're always going to push out? So if the imputed underpayment's 100,000 and your partners would have paid $80,000 in tax on the adjustments if you push out, and it costs you $30,000 to issue those statements, then you could still, free country, you're welcome to push out, but you've just made a poor economic decision where there's more cash going out of pocket than it would have been if you'd paid the imputed underpayment. So I personally, I think understanding the choices under BBA and then the are and like what each one of them do and what you can do with each one of them is probably the most important thing in BBA. These all come up during exam except for push out, which is right at the end once the FPAW is issued, because you need to be able to advise your client on what the best option is for that for your client for that particular circumstance. And it's never gonna there's not one right answer. It's always going to depend. Sometimes and it can depend on the audit. What may be the right answer for the client in audit of 2020 may not be the right option for the client in an audit of 2022. So I think this is probably the most important thing that you need to understand for BBA is that there are multiple choices within VBA, they do not have the same end result. So it's not like you can pick one, and whichever one you pick, you end up in the same place. No, they all have different end results. So, and that's intentional in BBA. And so, that's why it's so important for you to understand what the choices are. So the three major choices, you can pay the imputed underpayment, calculate on the adjustments, is a partnership level tax. It is not a partner tax. It is not calculated by any sh shape or form relative to partner tax. It has its own separate calculation, which we'll get into when we move to the next slide. You can request to modify the imputed underpayment, as Robert kind of went into. At that point, you can take into account the partner's facts and circumstances. It must be requested by the by the partnership, and there's specific types of modifications that can be requested. Again, I kind of mentioned, and then you can elect to push out the adjustment. So those are the three major choices that you have. The IRS can't take away any of these choices. These are always going to be your choices, unless you waive the FPAW and then you don't get it, and then you can't push out. But that's a choice that you've made. So it's important to realize that it's not always one right answer, and you really need to look at the facts and circumstances of a particular situation. Next slide, please. So here is a very basic, imputed underpayment calculation. It can get complicated, but for the most part, this is really it. It's lawyer math. So you appropriately net the adjustments. Then you multiply them by the highest rate under Section 1 or 11. Right now, that's Section 1, 37%, plus or minus adjustments to credits equals imputed underpayment. Basic math. So what does it mean to appropriately net the adjustments? Well, for the most part, if they will net on the Schedule K, then they will net in the calculation of the imputed underpayment. So Robert gave an example earlier where if you had an increase to ordinary income and a decrease to capital gain, those two things aren't going to offset each other. So because they are separately stated items. Otherwise, you could report everything as an ordinary loss, and even though it should be capital, and like there would be no consequence because the two adjustments would offset. So they can only be netted if they would net on the partnership return. That's the general. I would go by that. Usually, the IRS, if you, when you look at the form that the IRS gives you, when the like the 14791, 14792, 15027, they will group adjustments by the line item on the Schedule K, or the Schedule L, or I'm assuming the K2. I don't pretend to know much about the K2, so that's what you should look at as well. So, like if you increased ordinary supplies and professional fees, those all net into the Schedule K line one. So, those two things would net in your calculation of the imputed underpayment. But if it won't net on the partnership return, if it's required to be separately stated for any reason, then it's not going to net. And so, with the adjustments to credits, if you have an increase in credits, which would be a negative adjustment, then if you have an increase in credits, I mean decrease in credits, sorry, I hate credits because it's the opposite. If you decrease credits, that's a positive adjustment, and that will add to the imputed underpayment. But if it goes the other way, if you have a reduction in credits, it will not necessarily reduce the imputed underpayment. The IRS would need to determine that it should reduce the imputed underpayment. It's going to depend on kind of what the credit is. Just be aware of that. So if you're doing an imputed underpayment calculation as part of a AAR, you won't be able to, if you have a an increase in credits, you won't be able to offset the IU because an IRS has to determine otherwise. And so now you kind of heard, we're talking about how like all adjustments to partnership related items, if they're money, go into the calculation of the imputed underpayment, which is not at all normally how income taxes work. There's certain types of things that are taxed, certain types of things that aren't taxed. Well, that's not true. BBA treats all adjustments the same. It doesn't matter what they are, they're all taxed exactly the same. You just add them all up, multiply by the highest rate. It doesn't matter what the underlying item is. It pretty much loses its character, kind of, except for the netting issues when you're calculating the imputed underpayment. Next slide, please. So that's why this rule exists. I call this a subsume rule. That's not anywhere in the regulations. It's in the original preamble to the regulations. But the IRS has the ability to treat some adjustments as zero solely for purposes of calculating the IU if the effect of the adjustment is reflected in another adjustment. Now, there's really two parts to this rule under the regulation. There's the what I refer to as the IRS rule, and then there's the general rule. For this particular one, where the effect of an adjustment is reflected in another adjustment, that's the IRS has discretion to do that. They still make the adjustment, but it's just treated as zero as part of the IU calculation. It's not, it doesn't become an adjustment that does not result in an IR an imputed underpayment. It's very very broad authority, discretionary on part of the IRS. In the IRM, you'll see some examples of situations where it directs agents to use this rule. Oftentimes, if they increase ordinary income by $100, which also results in an increase in net earnings and self-employment and an increase in QBI, they'll treat the net earnings and self-employment and the QBI adjustments as zero because they only occurred because of that adjustment to the net ordinary income. Now, like all the cases that they're in court right now, if you didn't put your net earnings and self-employment as zero there, if they just adjust net earnings and self-employment, they're not going to treat it as zero. But then that's the second part of the rule, second sentence in the rule, the general rule, as I call it. It really says generally in the regulation. It says if you have a positive adjustment that is related to or results from another positive adjustment, one of those positive adjustments will generally be treated as zero unless the IRS determines otherwise. So you can kind of see related to or results from is narrower than reflected in. I mean, really, I think honestly, with that first part of the rule, the IRS has discretion to treat any adjustment it wants to as zero, as long as it determines it makes sense to do so, because reflected in is very subjective. But related to and result from is a little bit more objective. It's kind of a but-for causation test. And so you have to have two positive adjustments for this to work. Whereas in the first part of the rule with the IRS discretion, there's no requirement that there be positive adjustments. You can treat negative adjustments as zero. In fact, there's actually an example in the IRM of where that would happen. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. If you'd asked me yesterday, I probably would remember, but now I don't. You can the second part of the rule, this general rule, if you have two positive adjustments which are related to a result from one another, treating one as zero, partnerships can utilize this rule themselves when they do the AR. If they're doing an AR and they want to pay the imputed underpayment and they're calculating, they can use this part of the rule when they calculate that. So, and you can treat more than one adjustment as zero. Kind of like in my example I just gave a minute ago, where you increase ordinary income and it ordinary income increase also results in an increase in net earnings to self-employment and an increase in QBI. And in the example here I have on the slide, they're different amounts just to demonstrate that they don't have to be the same number. It doesn't have to be $100 across the board. It can be 100 for your ordinary income and 50 to QBI, 75 to net earnings to self-employment. It doesn't matter. They don't have to be the same amount. But they are all related to results from each other. So you would, in this particular example, you would treat the QBI and the net earnings to self-employment as zero because they relate to a result from the adjustment to the ordinary income. Now you're like, oh, well, it says as long unless the IRS determines otherwise, they're always going to determine otherwise, right? And I would say no. As a kind of general rule, general rules generally apply. And so there really, I would, in my view, it needs to be a reason why it shouldn't be treated as zero. And situations I can think of where that might apply is if people are using it abusively. Like, say, for example, you have two adjustments that relate to each other. One is $5 and one's $1 million. And you treat the $1 million adjustment as zero and the $5 adjustment as the subject to the IU. I could see the IRS determining otherwise in that case, and I think it would be relatively justified. So if you're using it abusively, the IRS may determine otherwise, but it's not, I would never expect it to be a situation where it's like, I don't like you, therefore I'm going to determine otherwise. Next slide, please. Forget what's slow. Oh, I got to 21. Adjustments that do not result in an imputed underpayment, ATDNR, is how I like to write it because I got super lazy typing out adjustments that do not result in an IU. So if you, after you've netted all your, appropriately netted all your adjustments, and we didn't go into groupings and subgroupings on this. That's way too deep for this presentation. Then if you end up with negative adjustments that can't net with anything else, those become adjustments that do not result in an IU, and they have a specific treatment under BBA, and it depends on which one of your choices you've picked. If you're paying the imputed underpayment, the partnership will take that adjustment into account on its adjustment year return. So in the example of you increase ordinary income and you decrease capital gain, that reduction in capital gain is an adjustment that does not result, and it will show up on the adjustment year return. They'll reduce their income or their capital gain on the adjustment year return and pay the imputed underpayment on the ordinary income. If there's a modification where partners are taking into account adjustments like amended return modification, the partners also take into account their allocable share of any adjustments that do not result in an IU. If you push out, so the all adjustments go with it, so the adjustments that do not result in it get pushed out as well. And if you're doing an AAR, if you have adjustments that do not result, they must be pushed out to the reviewed year partners. There's no choices. I think we're running low on time here. I'm going to turn it back over to Roberts to try to get through modification relatively quickly.
Okay, thank you, Jenny. Modification, basically, the partnership may request modification of the imputed underpayment, and it would have to submit Form 8940 through the IRS electronic portal. And this has to be done within 270 days after the NOPA is issued. But you can submit a Form 8984, the partnership, to request an extension, and it should be done in sufficient time so the IRS, if it approves the extension, can sign it before the expiration of the 207-day period. Now, normally, if there is a modification request, the normal procedure is that the partners for whom modification is sought, and it would be individual partners for whom you'd seek a modification, the partners would file an amended return for the reviewed year, taking into account all of the adjustments, regardless of whether they are included in the imputed underpayment. And they would then have to pay any tax, penalties, and interest if the modification results in additional tax at the time that when the modification is requested. Also, if there are changes to tax attributes, they would have to file amended returns for years affected by the changes. So if there is a reduction in a net operating loss due to the modification, then there would have to be amended returns filed, and if necessary, additional tax paid for the years affected by the reduction of the net operating loss. Now then, the IRS, if it denies a modifications, you can go to appeals. Now then, normally the statute does not give anyone the power to force someone to make a modification. And with respect to modifications where there is a reallocation of an item between two partners, such as they reallocate income from partner A to partner B. Partner B, whose income is reduced, cannot file a modification unless partner A, who got the additional income, also files a modification. And then the modification request is made by the partnership and signed by the partnership rep. Next page.
Yeah, we're going to have to decide how far we're going to go over because we have 34 slides in this deck and we're on slide 23. My recommendation is that we get through, if we get through the modification slide real quick, I'll hit push out really briefly and we can wrap up from that.
Okay. Well, then the regulations list the types of modification that can be requested. There's a rate modification, such as C corporations are taxed at a lower rate than individuals. So if a partner is a C corporation, it can do a modification request and it would pay lower tax than would be paid if the partnership paid the tax. capital gains and qualified dividend adjustments that are allocable to individuals and S corporations. They're going to be taxed at a lower rate than the ordinary income rate for individuals. Then, if there is a tax-exempt partner, you can seek a modification for the tax-exempt partner. And to the extent that there is, the tax-exempt income will not be include will be excluded from calculation of the IU, but if there's unrelated business taxable income of the tax-exempt entity, that will still go into the calculation of the IU. Amended return Pu-in modification. This is where the partners file amended returns and take into account their share of adjustments, number and composition, or as Jenny says, slice and dice. And basically, the example given in the regulation is a partnership with only two partners, both publicly traded C corporations, where there are two rental properties that on the return are treated as separate activities. There is a positive adjustment increasing income to one, and a negative adjustment increasing the loss to the other rental property. And if the partnership can substantiate the information that these are publicly traded partnerships and these should be treated as the same activity, they can net the increased loss of one property against the increased gain in the other. Then there are specified passive activity losses, and those relate to publicly traded partnerships. There are modifications for regulated investment companies, RICs, and real estate investment trusts. And that is, a partnership may request a modification based on deficiency dividends distributed under IRC Section 860A by a 860F by a relevant partner that is a RIC or an REIT. There are treaty benefits, and that is if a partner is a foreign individual and under a treaty income tax treaty between the IRS and that individual's company, the income would be taxed at either a lower rate or would be exempt from tax. Then that can be taken into account in a modification. Similarly, if there is a closing agreement between either the partnership or a partner, which treats a partnership-related item and the amount of any additional taxes paid, you can request a modification based on the closing agreement. And then a partnership can request a modification based on any other reason, and then the modifications have to be approved by the IRS, and the partnership has to provide all of the required information to substantiate that the modification is appropriate, and the partners and they have to include a declaration from the partners who filed amended returns that they have filed the returns and paid the tax both for the reviewed year and any affected year. And if the partnership is using the alternate method, they have to get a statement that the relevant partners have agreed to take into account adjustments to any tax attributes. And that is it for modification types.
All right, let's go ahead and switch real quick over to Twaddle 26 as a visual while I cover push out super quick, and then we'll have to just call it there. So as I kind of mentioned before, you have to have an FPAW in order to make a push out election. You do that on Form 8988. You have to be electronically submitted to the portal. That happens during exam. The PR has to sign the push out election. Once the adjustments become finally determined, i.e. that there either was a final court decision or the FPAW defaults, Partnership has 60 days to issue the push-out statements to its partners. That's Form 8986, and there's a transmittal that goes along with it, Form 8985. Once the partners receive those push-out statements, there's one of two options that happens. If the IT partner is a tax-paying entity, like a C-corp or an individual, the partners will calculate what their change in tax for the year under audit would have been if they had properly reported those items to begin with, and that increase or decrease in tax is an increase or decrease in their current year tax. I'm just going to say current year. It's the year in which the statements are furnished, but more than likely it's going to be on your next filed return. And if it's a pass-through partner, so it's another partnership, that pass-through partner must issue its own statements to its partners. And if it does not do that timely, then it has to pay an imputed underpayment calculated on those adjustments. Now, the problem with tiers is that every single tier has the same due date. All tiers must either push out or pay by the extended due date of the audited partnership's adjustment year return. So if the court decision became final today, 2025 is the adjustment year. So that means all pass-through partners all the way up the chain have until September 15th, 2026, regardless of whether or not the audited partnership has to file or it files an extension, has until that date. So if you are a pass-through partner and you receive one of these statements, be kind to those above you and get it done as soon as possible, because if you leave that person four tiers up holding the bag at the last, because they get their statement like the day before the end of the due date, and they have to pay the IU, they're not going to be happy with you. So be kind. Don't procrastinate. So if you go through the rest of the slides, you'll see we have a slide that goes through some of the costs and benefits of each particular choice. I kind of said earlier that I think that knowing these choices is probably the most important thing that you can get out of BBA. And it goes into a few other things, but we are already 10 minutes over. And I'm sure, at least for me, it's 4:40 in the afternoon. I know for you guys, it's a lot earlier, but I'm on the East Coast. So I think we're going to call it there. If there's any questions, you can feel free to reach out to one of us. Our contact information is on the first couple of slides. And I hope you enjoyed the presentation and to BBA.
Alrighty, this concludes today's presentation. Thank you both for taking the time out of your day to share with our members, and thank you so much to our audience. Have a good afternoon, everybody.
Thank you.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.